Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with the anniversary of 9/11/1973, when the American CIA and paramilitary personnel engineered and were deeply involved in a bloody military coup in Chile against the government of Salvador Allende, who had been elected the country's president 3 years earlier. Allende had been intent on initiating a form of socialist democracy with extensive land and financial reform, nationalizing major industries and banks controlled by U.S. corporate interests that previously dominated Chilean affairs. Allende was either murdered or committed suicide in an assault on the presidential capital by the Chilean army, which established the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet that imprisoned, murdered, and executed thousands of Chilean citizens. They would shoot you for just being left-handed, a person victimized by Chilean police and soldiers said. Pinochet and his generals governed Chile ruthlessly until democracy was finally restored without U.S. assistance, and popular elections deposed the militocracy in 1990. Pinochet died in exile. A much more recent 9/11 occurrence of concern to Americans happened in Libya on September 11, 2012. When Muslim militants attacked the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi and killed the American ambassador and three other U.S. diplomats, which resulted in an extensive and exhaustingly protracted partisan witch hunt by GOP congresspersons against Hillary Clinton, who had been U.S. Secretary of State at the time under President Barack Obama. The results were patently inconclusive and a large waste of legislatorial time and taxpayer money. The 9/11 we commemorate this Saturday, September 11, 2001, turned the world upside down, which was the title of a popular song the British Army played on its fifes and drums as it marched out of Yorktown, Virginia, after losing the American Revolution to colonial rebels and terrorists in October 1781. The astonishingly surprising and unprecedented suicide attack that completely destroyed the World Trade Center in New York City and severely damaged the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., at a catastrophic loss of lives on 9/11/2001. Has joined in infamy the Japanese air attack on Pearl Harbor 80 years ago on December 7, 1941. Neither target was merely a symbol of American power, but were instead true centers of the USA's military and economic New World Order. The appalling attack on the USA 20 years ago this Saturday claimed the worst death toll in a single day in American history, nearly double that of the Civil War's Antietam battle on 9/17/1862, which was the worst previous day of death and unprecedented since the arsonation of Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812, when the British attempted an imperial comeback. The specter of falling bodies of doomed persons trapped above the fires started by the jets crashing into the Twin Towers contrasts with the equally doomed firemen going up into the towers, passing fleeing survivors, escaping the fires underneath the inflamed kamikaze jets. Pearl Harbor 80 years ago this year was the main analogy initially drawn for 9/11. Complete surprise, a direct hit on the USA's symbols of wealth and power, epic destruction. The anger and instant desire for revenge were about the same as Pearl Harbor, also the heart-wrenching sense of tragedy, as well as the immediate finger-pointing at why 9/11 was allowed to happen. And like Pearl Harbor, 9/11 served as a rallying cry for revenge and war. 20 years of war. A significant difference from Pearl Harbor is that the USA has not been as undividedly united as the historic claim after Pearl Harbor. As Carlos Lozada wrote recently for the Washington Post this 20th anniversary, more Americans today are concerned about domestic terrorism than foreign terrorism. And that on January 6th this year, quote, our own citizens assaulted the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. that Al-Qaeda hoped to strike on September 11th, 2001, end quote. And that was Carlos Lozada. It is more than remotely possible that the real conspiracy of terror against the USA has been plotted at the highest levels of government in Saudi Arabia. Most of the 9/11 kamikazes were from there, as was the late Osama bin Laden. Saudi Arabians, if not specifically the government itself, have been at the center of world terrorism for decades, and President Joe Biden is promising to release classified secrets pertinent to Saudi Arabia's quite probable complicity. As much paranoid spook literature projects, there might be infinite layers of intrigue impossible to ascertain, even conceivable that separate agendas for reasons of opportunity or indispensability, such as the American Bush presidencies and bin Laden families in gray conspiracy leading to 9/11/2001, selling the USA soul for Saudi crude, as one writer has expressed it, and who can forget Donald Trump's slavering over Saudi supplication. There are few certainties among the disingenuousness, principally that the two decades since 9/11, the so-called war on terror, is no closer to closure than the day it ostensibly started with the awesomely awful attack on the USA that congealed the calendar to forever 9/11, and the national angst converged into a highly charged personal nightmare that a skyjacked jet airliner packed with helpless captives is aimed at all our windows. And that was something I wrote about September 11th. And now, Counterbabble by Judith Griffiths. We have heedlessly rushed into a process that we cannot reverse, and we do not really know what will be the fallout of the changes that take place. We do know that a great deal that has been of proven value for centuries, even millennia, will probably be lost. Language, culture, and the genuine spiritual as well as human understanding it has served to convey, the unbroken memory of generations past that is still a focus of reverence in intact old societies, and the future that would have grown out of such societies if their ways had prevailed. Do we really want to sweep all of this away with little more than a backward glance? The terrorists who attacked on September 11th may not have been consciously aware of such motives, but these are implicit in their actions, and I wish to see the victims honored by our treating the entire incidents as rife with understanding to be gained with little further effort. If the terrorists intended nothing but mindless destruction, we can deprive their actions of nihilism by wresting something good from them. In spite of their intent, we may seem destined to achieve a common language and reverse the momentum of the original fall of Babel at any cost. If we can do so at less cost to ourselves, all of ourselves, globally, are we not obligated to do so? And that was Counter Babel by Judith Griffiths. who lived in Astoria when she wrote this just after 9/11, 2001. And the poem now by Jesse Duncan, titled September 11th. Thunder in the wind, no rain. Peace mourns its passing, no pain. We are still human, but our existence is bane. Do we not bleed and die? It is always the same refrain. Nothing is right. Terrorism shakes its ugly mane. Are we not all human? Do we not feel pain? Peace comes to an end as the old moon wanes. Jets fly overhead. We decide to take trains. We are struck by horror. We are struck with pain. What do we do when the time comes again? Send our boys into battle. Watch them die in vain. Peace waves goodbye as war says hello again. And that was September 11th. Jesse Duncan wrote this poem right after 9/11 when she was 16, and it appeared in the January-February 2002 issue of the North Coast Times-Eagle. She was a junior at Astoria High School and a perennial in Shanghai'd in Astoria for many summers, often as Virginia Sweet. And now, from The Guardian. It's time to brace ourselves for a world without Roe versus Wade. Here's what we must do. By Catherine Colbert and Julie F. Kay. Since Roe versus Wade was decided nearly 50 years ago, abortion opponents have been plotting its demise. Now the end may be near. Feminists need our own plan to advance reproductive freedom. That means preparing for a post-Roe world. That's not a future any of us want, but it is one for which we must be ready. First, we must stop banging our heads against the Supreme Court's marble walls. Republicans have successfully stacked our federal courts with anti-abortion judges who believed that Roe was wrongly decided and are willing to reverse it. By 2020, the Supreme Court had a solid 6-3 anti-Roe majority in place. This fall, it will consider Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, a challenge to a Mississippi abortion ban that is an in-your-face test of Roe's staying power. Whether or not Dobbs is the case that reaches the Roe levy, the federal courts are not our friends, and the U.S. Supreme Court is not our savior. The Supreme Court failed to block a Texas law which bans abortion as early as 6 weeks and allows, and indeed incentivizes, any abortion opponent to sue any person who assists a woman seeking an abortion. While abortion rights supporters should do everything we can to reverse these trends, we need to rally around a long-term, multi-pronged strategy, just as the anti-abortion movement implemented since Roe. In the last two decades, a number of innovative advances for women's equality and reproductive justice have been made that must be replicated and expanded. The reproductive justice movement, led by women of color, has successfully exposed the link between systemic racism and the denial of reproductive freedom. They launched the effort that is gaining momentum to end the insidious Hyde Amendment, which has deprived Medicaid recipients of abortion funding since 1976, and have emphasized that true choice includes a full range of reproductive options. Situating abortion rights within the fight for fair access to health care for all is the smart next step. The menu of reforms must provide unhindered contraceptive access, including making the pill available over the counter. Address the U.S.'s appalling rates of infant and maternal mortality, which are experienced by Black women in particular, provide gender-inclusive and gender-affirming health care for LGBTQ plus people, and provide fertility treatment for all, not just those who can afford it. Medication abortion, a safe, effective way to end pregnancy, is stymied by politically motivated restrictions, which must be abolished. Mid-level medical providers are well able to prescribe medication abortion and, as we have seen during the pandemic, telemedicine can increase access to safe abortion in areas of the country that lack providers. Providing the medication by mail through walk-in clinics and in university health centers would allow patients to skip the hassle of traveling to clinics where there are often gauntlets of protesters. But let's be frank, when abortion is made illegal or inaccessible, it doesn't go away, it goes underground. If Roe is overturned, many conservative states will leap at the chance to make abortion illegal. Progressive states will have to step up to assist women forced to travel for reproductive health care. In the days before Roe, too many women risked their lives and fertility undergoing abortions by shady, illegal providers. Some were fortunate to access safer abortion services offered by feminist networks, such as the Jane Collective and the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. Today, with the advent of less risky medication abortion, activists and attorneys can support women who self-induce abortions, which is not always a first choice, but frequently a necessary one. We must prevent overzealous prosecutors from bringing criminal charges against those who self-induce abortion or the people who assist them. Now is the time to move beyond saving Roe and set in motion human rights-infused strategies that can unify abortion rights supporters and the broader women's, LGBTQ+, and racial justice movements. When right-wing state legislators whip up their base at the expense of reproductive freedoms, we need to cry out with loud and creative protests and demand that corporations and politicians join the call for our rights. As the Supreme Court diminishes Roe, let's call for a blitz of laws in Democratic-led states that assert abortion as a right for all who need it. To counter the chill of this ultra-conservative Supreme Court, we propose a long-term goal, a constitutional amendment providing for gender equity. This supercharged Equal Rights Amendment would guarantee full equality and protection for sexuality and reproductive freedoms for all, and without harmful government interference or denial of access to key services because of one's income, race, or geography. Let's begin this bold action by building the political power necessary to make such an amendment a reality. If and when the Trump reconfigured Supreme Court succeeds in taking apart Roe, we know this will not be the immediate end of abortion rights in the U.S. Rather, it is the beginning of a new stage of the fight. It is time now for a more audacious, collaborative movement to safeguard and expand the reproductive freedom that is a human right for all. And that was, it's time to brace ourselves for a world without Roe versus Wade. Here's what we must do. And its authors, Catherine Colbert and Julie F.K., are the authors of Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom. Kay is a human rights attorney who has argued for abortion rights internationally, including before the European Court of Human Rights in A, B, and C versus Ireland, which spurred liberalization of Ireland's abortion law. Colbert is a public interest attorney who co-founded the Center for Reproductive Rights and argued Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the 1992 Supreme Court case, widely credited with saving Roe versus Wade. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser-Schalk is engineer of this program. Revered former Mayor Edith Henningsgaard has died at age 97. Her death lays to rest 20th century Astoria. The late Mary Steinbach, longtime Astoria First Lady, would understand. So would the still alive Willis Van Dusen, longest serving mayor and transitionary legacy of the millennial conjunction and bicentennial of the oldest city in the American West. We in Oregon continue to be immersed in a localized surge of extra-virulent COVID virus, more lethal than previously, a surge of disease and death, most flagrantly in southern Oregon, where vaccine resistors proliferate in Josephine County, which bears the name of my deceased mother. This is not a time to slacken virus vigilance. Insist family and friends vaccinate, mask up, and lock down if necessary. Don't let the anti-vaxxers make you sick.